Good day, and welcome to the 20th presentation by Drinker Brittle of Inside the Beltway. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riesch. Please go ahead.
Hey, Ashley. Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Beltway. Today's program is going to cover primarily the recent and somewhat surprising development for the fiduciary rule. And then to the extent that we have time, we will cover some of the potential tax proposals and their impact on retirement plans. But I want to let you know that we will allow time at the end, the last 15 minutes or so, to make sure we handle your questions. As I said, I'm Fred Riesch. I'm the head of what we call the Financial Services ERISA team at Drinker Biddle, meaning that we're the group of attorneys, the ERISA attorneys, securities lawyers, who represent service providers to plans, that is, companies that sell products and services to retirement plans and IRAs. With me is Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. Brad is the former Assistant Secretary of the Employee Benefits Security Administration at the Department of Labor, and also importantly, his practice focuses on representing financial service companies as they provide services and products to ERISA plans and IRAs. And also with me is Jim Dolan from NetTixis. Jim is the Vice President for Retirement Strategies, and Jim is the reason we're having this call. Thanks to Jim and NetTixis, we're able to do these quarterly calls because of their sponsorship. And Jim, we really appreciate that. Thank you so much for doing this. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you all are up to?
Certainly, Fred. Thanks so much. And I just want to thank you and Brad for your insight in our call today. And I want to thank Drinker Biddle for the partnership. It's been going on about 3 years, so we're grateful that we're able to provide these types of calls. And most importantly, I want to thank everyone for calling in today. For those of you who are unfamiliar with NetTixis, we are a multi-affiliate asset manager. And there are just two pieces of news that I was hoping to share with you. Barron's recently recognized NetTixis as the top mutual fund family for 2016, which is great news, and we're proud of that. And we also wanted to share with you that NetTixis has recently launched a suite of target date mutual funds focused on ESG investing. So we're hoping to allow participants to align their values with their investments. So just a couple things that I wanted to share with you. We'd invite you to learn more about NetTixis at durableportfolios.com. And again, Fred, Brad, thanks so much, and thank you to everyone who's called in today.
Hey, Jim. Thank you, and thanks to NetTixis, and keep up the good work.
Certainly.
We have almost 1,000 people registered for this call today, and I think that gives you an indication of the interest in this subject. So let's jump right into it. As I said earlier, the guidance issued by the Department of Labor, the final guidance on the extension of the applicability date, came as a surprise to almost everybody. In fact, I don't know anybody that it wasn't a surprise to. And Brad will talk about a couple of the reasons, particularly with regard to the exemptions. But I'm going to talk about the fiduciary rule itself, that is, the regulation that redefines fiduciary advice to cover many, many, many more recommendations and advisors and agents who make those recommendations to plans and IRAs. So let's start off. On June 9, the new applicability date, the fiduciary regulation, as it was first published last April, a year ago, becomes applicable, lock, stock, and barrel. Not one comma is changed. It is the definition of fiduciary advice applicable on June 9 and thereafter, unless and until it's revised as a part of the overall review and analysis that the Department of Labor is doing of these rules. So everything you've been listening to for the past year, all the examples of different circumstances that would amount to fiduciary advice and cause the advisor to be a fiduciary, become applicable on June 9, just the way you've been hearing about it. What does that mean? Well, it means any recommendation of an investment or an investment strategy is going to be to an IRA or a plan or a participant is going to be fiduciary advice. Any recommendation of insurance products and annuities to plans, participants, and IRAs is going to be fiduciary advice. any referral to another fiduciary. And remember, almost everybody making recommendations will be a fiduciary, so that's more than just investment managers. It also includes other non-discretionary fiduciaries. Any referral accompanied by a fee, for example, a solicitor's fee or a finder's fee, referral fee, will be fiduciary advice. Any recommendation to a participant to take a distribution and roll over to an IRA or to take it out of one plan and move it to another plan will be fiduciary advice. Any recommendation to transfer an IRA from another provider, for example, a broker-dealer, to you will be fiduciary advice on June 9th. If you're not ready for that, you have about 7 weeks to get ready. I mean, they're, because each one of those has certain requirements associated with it. So what does that mean? Well, to take it even a step further, a recommendation is defined as a suggestion that a plan, a participant, or an IRA owner engage in or refrain from a particular course of investment action. A suggestion is drafted very, very broadly to in order to avoid people wordsmithing and trying to get around the rule. So a suggestion, think about how broad that is. And then the suggestion just has to be specifically directed to the investor, the plan fiduciary, the participant, or the IRA owner, specifically directed. What specifically directed mean? Well, obviously, if you're sitting down with one of those investors and you say, I think this is a great mutual fund for your IRA or plan or account, that is specifically directed. What if you're putting on a one of these dinner seminars where there's like 20 people in the room? The DOL has suggested that's small enough to be specifically directed. What if you're at a conference and some of the conference speakers are talking to 500 people in the audience? Well, the DOL has said that's not specifically directed. Same thing with different talk shows, TV shows, radio shows, and the like. Generally speaking, those will not be specifically directed. Nonetheless, it's quite broad. It's not just you saying, I recommend this to you. Bigger than that. So that will be fiduciary advice. So what's the consequence? On June 9, any of those types of advice that I've already mentioned will cause the advisor to be a fiduciary, meaning that if it's advice to a plan or a participant, which would include, for example, rollover recommendations, that is governed by ERISA's prudent man rule and duty of loyalty. The prudent man rule says that, in so many words, that the advisor has to engage in a prudent process, that of a knowledgeable person, and evaluate the information that a knowledgeable person would evaluate before making the recommendation. And the recommendation has to be made with a duty of loyalty to the investor, the plan participant, or the participant, under advice to plans and participants. Let me give you a couple of examples of that. Let's say we're talking about recommending a distribution. What is a prudent process? Well, we know at the least there are three components to that. Number one is gathering information about the investments, the services, and the expenses in the plan, because part of a recommendation of a distribution is to sell the investments in the plan and get cash. So that's an investment recommendation, so you have to know what's there. The second part is, well, what are the investments, services, and expenses in the IRA going to look at? Because you have to do a comparative analysis between the two. But there's a third part. It's not just comparing the two. You have to compare the two relative to the individual. And simply stated, or maybe overly simply, but to give you an idea, what are the needs and circumstances of the participant or the plan? In the rollover case, the participant. What do they need? What are the circumstances? Do the plans, do the investment services and expenses in the plan more appropriately meet that? Or do the investment services and expenses in the IRA more appropriately meet that when viewed in terms of the needs and circumstances of the participant relative to retirement? Because remember, this is retirement money. It's coming from a retirement plan into an individual retirement account. It's retirement money. That's what has to be gathered. That's the facts that have to be gathered. Then those three buckets of information need to be evaluated and then a prudent recommendation made. A prudent recommendation would be one that bears a reasonable relationship to the information evaluated. And, of course, there's always that overlay of the duty of loyalty to the participant. Well, what if you're going to recommend an annuity to, let's say, an IRA owner, or to a, I'm sorry, to a plan, such that you're subject to the prudent man rule? And, by the way, this also will apply under the best interest standard of care, which would be more under the would be caused by the exemptions, but for IRAs. But let me talk about it here in terms of just prudence to a plan, and it would be analogous for IRAs. To recommend that annuity, there's really not only do you go through the same thing about what are the needs of the and circumstances of the participant or the plan, but then you have to, and the rules are quite clear under this under ERISA, you have to evaluate the financial stability of the insurance company because you're making a recommendation about an investment, that is an annuity, that will make its payments 20, 30, 40 years from now. So you need to do an evaluation that based on today's circumstances, it is reasonable to believe that that insurance company will be around 20, 30, 40 years from now to make all those payments. You don't have to be, the issue isn't really around them. The issue is based on today's information, is that a reasonable position? That's area number one. And area number two, and there are guidelines on that under ERISA. I mean, there's some guidance out there. Then number two, which you find in the preamble to, it was either the fiduciary rule or the best interest contract exemption, when the DOL talked about fixed indexed annuities, they get into what are the terms and the conditions, what are the features, the benefits, and the costs of the IRA, and which of those are appropriate for that investor. So an analysis of the particular terms, features, benefits, and costs of that particular contract, that IRA contract. So it's not just an off-the-shelf recommendation. There needs to be a prudent process to evaluate that in terms, in light of the needs and circumstances of the investor. Having said that, I think that we will see over the years ahead that more and more recommendations about guaranteed lifetime income will be given because people are retiring at 65 and they could live for another 20 or 30 years. So I'm not, to the extent that I made that sound like annuities are too demanding, I don't mean that at all. I think there's a real place for them going forward. Okay, now let me flip over to fiduciary advice to IRAs. And the prudent man rule, as we know it, does not apply to IRAs. That is, the ERISA prudent man rule does not apply to IRAs. It is not a standard of care for IRAs. However, the definition of fiduciary is significant because it determines whether or not a prohibited transaction has occurred. As Brad will be able to explain the reasoning, that means that you're ultimately going to have to adhere to the best interest standard of care in cases where you're making recommendations to IRAs that cause prohibited transactions. That could be that you're getting a commission from an insurance company, or you're getting a front-end commission on a mutual fund, or trailing payments. Any third-party payments would be prohibited transactions. So what is this best interest standard of care that I'm talking about? It is the prudent man rule from ERISA. One word change, only one, and that is the word man has changed to person so that it's more up to date. Now, it goes on beyond that. There's also a part that says in light of the needs and circumstances of the participant. And then the last part of the best interest standard of care says with a duty of loyalty to the IRA owner. So, but essentially it's ERISA's duty of loyalty and ERISA's prudent man rule. In other words, it's essentially the same standard as ERISA's. Now, there's language in the DOL guidance that says, to help you out for IRAs, just in case these concepts seem novel for IRAs, there is history of guidance and litigation and court decisions under ERISA that goes back more than 40 years, and you can look to that for guidance. For example, under ERISA, some of the guidance and the litigation, the court decisions, have said that in providing investment advice to plans, which would now transfer over to IRAs, you need to apply generally accepted investment theories, for example, modern portfolio theory, diversification, asset class diversification, diversification within an asset class, and you need to apply prevailing investment industry standards. For example, when you evaluate a mutual fund, you look at the expense ratio. You look at the management of the mutual fund. You look at the track record. I mean, what is the prevailing investment industry standard for evaluating mutual funds and recommending them? You look to generally accepted investment theories, which would be, as I said, modern portfolio theory, strategic asset allocation, diversification, maybe at the edges some tactical asset allocation. And then you look to prevailing investment industry standards, which for mutual funds would be the application of qualitative and quantitative measures. So all that stuff, that for those of you who work with ERISA plans, all that stuff you've been complying with for ERISA plans, that on June 9, that moves over to recommendations to IRAs. And it may not be the same amount of work because IRAs are much smaller, but the same basic concepts will apply. So my final statement before I flip it over to Brad is, on June 9, 7 weeks from now, advisors will become, who are not already fiduciaries, will become fiduciaries for plans, participants, and IRAs for the recommendations that they make. That's really coming up fast. I just encourage you all to work on this very quickly. So, Brad, with that fiduciary discussion, why don't you take us into the exemptions and where we are on those?
Yeah, thanks, Fred, and thanks again to all of you for taking the time to join us here again. As Fred is trying to emphasize, and let me join in this as well, the department threw us a curveball in that they, instead of doing as the president's memorandum back in February suggested, which was review the fiduciary rule, determine whether it's having negative effects, and then decide whether to repeal it, replace it, or modify it. Instead, the Labor Department has decided to allow it to go forward in significant part, and then decide whether to amend it, replace it, or repeal it down the road. And in order to facilitate that apply-then-review process, the Labor Department has provided some transitional exemptions that are going to, even though the fiduciary provisions apply, allow you to nonetheless still have certain traditional forms of compensation under relatively easy-to-meet exemption requirements through the end of the year. So in other words, the trade-off the Labor Department gave us was, we're going to implement the fiduciary standard starting June 9th, you're going to have to comply with that. And as Fred said, and I really think this is worth emphasizing, without changing a single word of the Obama fiduciary standard. So the Obama-era regulation, in all of its fiduciary particulars, is going into effect on June 9th unchanged. But what is being changed is that there is a new transition BIC exemption, best interest contract exemption, and a new transition 8424 exemption in particular, and there's some other changes to other exemptions, but we're going to focus on those too, that provides fairly minimal requirements for June 9th through December 31st of 2017. And in that period, the Labor Department is going to review the information it's received about the rule. You all probably recall that along with the proposal to delay the applicability date by 60 days, the Labor Department also requested, with a 45-day comment period, new information about the economic impact the rule was having, and the deadline for submitting those comments was Monday a week ago, April 17th. So those comments have now been submitted. The Labor Department's going to review those and determine, based on that information and other things it looks at, whether to make changes going forward. But as Fred said, June 9th, I think, is a deadline that we have to treat as the deadline. The Labor Department said that it was unlikely to issue any further delays in the final delay rule that gave us June 9th. It's possible they could change their mind, but I'm not going to hold my breath on that. Just like it's possible Congress could theoretically impose an extension of the applicability date, and there's discussions on Capitol Hill to do that, but I wouldn't hold my breath on those either. There's going to be a lot of controversy coming up on the Hill in the near future about tax reform, about the debt limit extension, about funding the government, all the things you're hearing about in the press. I don't think we can rely on Congress to make a deadline extension here either. So we really need to focus on June 9th as the day. So these exemptions, the changes, these transitional exemptions, become very important. So what they've done is, let's start with the BIC exemption first. The BIC exemption, they've removed all of the other requirements that were in the original BIC exemption transition rule. Section 9 of the original BIC exemption provided a transition BIC for the rest of this year, which had certain notice requirements and some other conditions in it. Those have all been removed in the new transition BIC. The sole requirements are meeting the impartial conduct standards. And the impartial conduct standards consist really of three items. First, that you use the best interest standard. So in other words, the fiduciary process. And we'll talk some more about that, but to me that's very circular, but nonetheless that's what they've done. If you're, you have to abide by the fiduciary standard in the first place, and you're allowed to receive compensation during the transition period that would otherwise be prohibited, commissions like Fred mentioned, for example, provided you use a prudent fiduciary process as one of the three elements of the impartial conduct standards. So for that reason alone, using the next 7 weeks to get your fiduciary process completed, in place, and ready to use is crucial, because it's not only the legal standard you have to meet on the front end, it's the standard you have to meet on the back end to avoid a prohibited transaction for receiving a traditional commission. So that's the first of the three impartial conduct standards. The second is that you charge no more than reasonable fees. The reasonableness of fees is a concept that in the ERISA world people have dealt with since the beginning, and is generally viewed to mean that if I looked at my fees in relation to what the market is charging for similar services, am I somewhere in that general cluster in the middle, or am I an outlier? And if you're an outlier, that's where you have to ask the question, is our fee reasonable? And that's where you can look at other ways to measure it. You could look at a cost accounting basis saying, you know, here's how much it costs us to provide this service. Here's our reasonable profit on top of that. Therefore, we can justify that higher fee. But most people, I think, generally look at it more as a measure of where do you fall in the marketplace. And if you're in that general range of what most others are charging for similar services, then your fee is going to be reasonable. But you need to have something in that file before June 9th that says you've looked at that question, that you've done some sort of benchmarking analysis of your fees, that you have something in there to show that you've done some work to establish that your fees are reasonable. The third element of the BIC exemption and of the impartial conduct standards, the transitional BIC exemption, is that you are making no materially misleading statements with regard to any of the things that you're telling participants or IRA owners about your recommendations. And in general, I think that's a fairly straightforward standard. It's materially misleading at the time they're made is actually the standard that's referred to in the impartial conduct standards. So for the BIC exemption, you don't have to send out a notice requirement. You don't have to affirmatively acknowledge fiduciary status. There aren't any paperwork requirements imposed by the BIC exemption in this transition period, but you have to meet those three elements of the impartial conduct standards. Now, a word about that, just because there aren't explicit requirements in the BIC exemption, transition BIC exemption for notice and disclosure, doesn't mean there may not be other applicable rules. For example, if you are currently a non-fiduciary advisor to a plan committee, you're providing a 408B2 notice in all likelihood, and you're going to have to update that notice if you're now a fiduciary, because one of the requirements of 408B2 is that you, if you're a fiduciary, you identify yourself as such and explain what services you're a fiduciary for. So if you're talking about plans and you're currently not a fiduciary but you're going to become one after June 9th, there is a 408B2 notice requirement, even though there isn't a specific requirement in the transition BIC. That does not apply to IRAs, however. 408B2 notices don't apply to IRAs. So there is a distinction between how plans and IRAs are treated for that purpose. Now, the other big exemption that we're anticipating a lot of people looking at is prohibited transaction 8424. And this is used for sales of annuities and for insurance contracts. What the Obama administration put in the final rule was that the 8424 exemption could not be used for variable annuities or fixed index annuities. Those had to go through the BIC exemption. And that created several problems. They also changed the definition of commission, changed some of the disclosure requirements. They made a number of changes to 8424. Collectively, those changes created a problem, particularly for independent insurance agents, because to sell fixed index annuities or variable annuities, you would have to have a financial institution able to enter into a BIC exemption. And that, by the way, requirement still applies. The BIC exemption is for use by financial institutions, even though there's no required contract or notices. It still goes through financial institutions. So under the Obama changes to 8424, it created a real issue as to what would independent insurance agents do for those products, because there was a real – it wasn't likely that insurance carriers would be accepting financial institution status for people they didn't supervise. So there were, as you probably recall, a lot of applications to the Labor Department to get a special exemption for insurance intermediaries, FMOs, IMOs, and others, to be able to enter into a similar exemption to the BIC exemption. That was a proposal, a proposed class exemption put out on the second to last day of the Obama administration. The comment period has closed and all those were taken, but we've had no indication as to what was going to happen moving forward. What the Labor Department did in the final delay rule, where they put in a transitional 8424, good from June 9th to the end of this year, was to address that problem by saying, okay, we're going to revert back to the previous 8424 with the addition of the impartial conduct standards. So what that means is that the 2006 version, which was the last time 8424 was amended, which includes VAs, FIAs, all annuities, not just fixed-rate annuities, you can use 8424 with its old, so to speak, conditions, which do include disclosure requirements and a few other items. In other words, 8424, as it has always been, now applies through the rest of the year with the addition of the impartial conduct standards. So again, you have the best interest standard, you have the reasonable compensation standard, and no materially misleading statement standard applying in transition 8424. There is some question about how, if at all, the materially misleading statement issue has changed in 8424, because there is some language that an omission of a material statement could be misleading. I think we've largely viewed that as a distinction without a difference, because the information that you're required to disclose would include essentially all the material information already, so it probably isn't a problem to particularly be concerned about, but there is that technical difference in language. So for both of these exemptions, the key message that DOL was trying to send is, we're buying time to look at changing the rule by giving you some interim transitional exemptions that basically just impose the fiduciary standard as their primary requirements, and not all of the additional things that you all have told us you're concerned about with these exemptions. And that'll give us time to fix or address or review the rule while you all have a lesser compliance burden than you otherwise would have had. Now, that's the position of the department. I think there's still a lot of I don't know that you would all agree that it's a much lesser compliance burden, but that is sort of why the department did what it did. That's kind of the quick, although I know that was long, the quick overview of those provisions. Fred, anything you want to add about that?
Yeah, let me just I want to emphasize one thing that Brad said about you need to have data about reasonable compensation in your files. These are the best interest contract exemption and 8424, both of which have reasonable compensation limitations, because that's one of the three parts of the impartial conduct standards, are exemptions. That is, they're exceptions to prohibited transactions. As exceptions to a general rule, the burden of proof is on the person claiming the exception or the exemption. In other words, if you're listening to this and you're an advisor, you're going to have to prove that your compensation was reasonable. It's not up to the investor to prove that it was unreasonable. So there is a shifting of the burden of proof, which, a bunch of legalese, but it has real significance. And I think at a practical level, it's exactly what Brad said. It's that you need something in your file. And I think the difficulty of that, with retirement plans, there's so much data on compensation, competitive compensation, what fees are for a $5 million plan, what they are for a $50 million plan, on and on. But in hindsight, now that I'm doing so much more IRA work, all of us are, we realize IRAs are much, much more complicated. For example, what's reasonable compensation for an individual fixed rate annuity, initially and trailing? What is reasonable compensation for an individual fixed indexed annuity, initial and trailing? What is reasonable compensation for an individual variable annuity, first year and trailing? I mean, and that's just three. Think of all the other categories, individual securities, referrals to investment managers, mutual funds, alternative investments. Each one of those has its own set of services. Because remember, reasonable compensation is service-driven. It's not product-driven, except to the extent that different products require different levels of service and sophistication by the advisors. So each one of those needs a reasonable compensation analysis. It's not just go grab some chart off the shelf. And the burden of proof is on you, which is why, as Brad was saying, it's so important that you have information. One other point that Brad and I have been talking about over the last couple of months is that, since this final rule came out, the BICE transition rule, is that even though there's no specific documentation requirement, there are these little things lying in the weeds that you shouldn't think there's no requirement for documentation anywhere. Brad mentioned one of them, the 408B2 notice, amending your pre-existing notices, which you have to do shortly after June 9th, to say, oh, by the way, that old notice I gave you, I'm amending that to say I'm now a fiduciary because of these new rules. The failure to send out the 408B2 notice causes your relationship to the plan to become a prohibited transaction if you don't send out the amended notice, meaning you have no right to compensation from that plan. So that's one. Another one that's lying in the weeds, in my view, and this is the one I was saying Brad and I have been talking about, in addition to 408B2, is that while there's no requirement to give a written notice to plans, participants, and IRAs that you're going to use transition BICE, there is one of the components or one of the requirements of the impartial conduct standards imposed by the transition rule is that you adhere to the best interest standard of care, which is essentially the prudent man rule and the duty of loyalty. There's a lot of guidance from ERISA, which I think will come over to IRAs, that says that the documentation of your process as a fiduciary is an essential part of a prudent process. In other words, the information you have to gather and review, maybe the process for reviewing it. That documentation of those steps could very well be viewed as being so essential a part of a prudent process that the failure to document and retain that documentation would void the process. I'm overstating that a little bit, but there is a worry there. So, Brad, those are the things.
Well, I was going to say on that point, regardless of whether there's strictly a legal obligation to document or not, if you don't document it, then it essentially never happened in terms of trying to prove what happened later. So I don't think you're – let me put it this way. I would hope your counsels won't let you get away without documenting it, whether it's a requirement of the rule or not, because it is going to be a requirement for you being able to successfully defend yourselves when you're challenged. That documentation part really is essential for all of those reasons, most importantly, I think, for your own protection.
Yeah, I thought I would throw out a couple of examples, Brad, and feel free to as well, of what we're seeing clients actually do. For example, to adhere to the prudent man rule or the best interest standard, as I said earlier, you have to vet the mutual funds. You have to say, are they prudent to recommend, which in my view, the prudent man rule and the best interest standard of care puts a lot more focus on the expense ratios of the mutual fund than the suitability standard does. It also puts more focus on the quality of investment management than the suitability standard does. So both of those, I think, will mean that mutual funds are going to be more closely vetted going forward. Not to the extreme, don't get me wrong, I mean, but more, just a matter of degree. Some broker-dealers are going so far as saying, well, wait a second, we're only going to permit 20, I'm throwing out 20 as a hypothetical, the fund families to be sold to qualified money, being planned, meaning plans and IRAs. And so they're saying, as long as we as a broker-dealer are a co-fiduciary with our advisor, we want to manage that part. We're going to only allow these fund families to be sold. Other broker-dealers are saying, well, no, our relationship with our advisors and our culture is that the home office doesn't impose those kind of restrictions. Instead, we're going to say advisors can only use pre-approved software for the selection and monitoring of mutual funds used for qualified money. But that reflects the division of fiduciary responsibility between the broker-dealer or any entity, could be the RIA firm, or the insurance company, or the bank, between the entity and the individual advisor. They are both fiduciaries now. They have co-fiduciary responsibility in the sense that when there's a lawsuit filed for imprudence, they'll both be named. So that's something needs to be done about that. How are those fiduciary responsibilities going to be allocated between the entity and the individual, and what will the response be?
That's a great segue to a point I think that FAs in particular need to keep in mind, which is your financial institutions have all along been working on compliance plans, which they may have revealed some or all of it, depending on what they thought was going to happen with the deadlines and how close they were. They've probably had to reevaluate those plans in light of the final rule, which has implemented the fiduciary provisions but changed the exemptions so that they may not have to make as many changes on the compensation side, but they definitely are having to make changes to implement the fiduciary side. And so I think for those of you who are financial advisors affiliated with particularly some larger financial institutions, they're going to be getting out to you shortly essentially what they want their new processes to be. So in terms of where does the burden fall on compliance, I think for most of you who are financial advisors, it's falling on your institutions who are then going to tell you what they want you to do and how they want you to do it. And we're going to see sort of a flurry of new instructions, new paperwork, and training coming over the next 7 weeks to get you ready for June 9th. So for those of you listening thinking, well, how am I supposed to do all this? I think for most of you as financial advisors, it's going to be done for you, and it's a question of doing what your financial institution comes out and tells you is the plan. Obviously, for the institutions, it's a whole different question. They've got to develop all those things, implement their plans, make the adjustments. And that's why for all of us, June 9th is actually, I put it this way, perversely, by giving only a 60-day delay after signaling that it was probably going to be a much longer review before they decided what to do. In some ways, we have less time to comply maybe than we did before. Because from November on, once President Trump was elected, the assumption was the target we'd be shooting for compliance would not be the same target. And that's affected the preparation levels. So, you know, I think we're all having to scramble a little bit to deal with real-world implementation of the bulk of the rule when we did not expect that to happen as quickly as it has, going back to Fred's point about this rule in many ways being a surprise to everybody.
Yeah, I will tell you, picking up on what Brad's saying, that up until the presidential memo came out, most of my work was helping people comply with the best interest contract exemption. Now that's shifted over to fiduciary compliance. So there is that shift that Brad just mentioned, and there is the June 9 deadline to fully make the shift, make decisions, develop the internal processes, the policies and procedures, the decisions about how advice will be given, train or educate the advisors, and be up and running on June 9. That's a lot. Also, going back to what I see people doing, you know, for individual variable annuities, fixed rate annuities, and fixed indexed annuities, under these rules, as Brad explained, under the transition rules, you could either go under 8424 or BIC. Just a few months ago, you would have guessed, given that choice, everybody would have gone under 8424, which has a few more disclosures, but it doesn't require a financial institution. And even if it did, the financial institution wouldn't be a co-fiduciary. But with these changes, the BIC exemption was made so much easier to live with than 8424, much less disclosure, less in writing, on and on, that every financial institution that I'm working with, at least to the extent they've told me their decisions, has decided to go under transition BIC and just adhere to the three impartial conduct standards. The only people that I see going under 8424, at least to the clients I'm talking to, are independent insurance agents, where the insurance companies may not want to sign on as a co-fiduciary, so they lack a financial institution, and as a result, they can't use transition BIC. So that seems to be the split that I'm saying. Brad, is that pretty much what you're saying, too?
Yeah, I put just a little more nuance on it, which is to the extent institutions have been using 8424 historically, they're not dismantling that and going away from it. It's probably more that by virtue of complying with 8424, you've already complied with BIC because the impartial conduct standards are both. So you kind of have a fallback. I guess what I'd say is to say what you're saying a different way, yes, I think initially everyone assumed 8424 was going to be the more user-friendly exemption, and now that's reversed. And so in places where they're looking at using a new exemption, I think very clearly BIC is transition BIC is the preference. I wouldn't say they're dismantling existing 8424 relationships, and I'd say those same carriers who often have both distribution networks that can use BIC as well as distribution networks that need to use 8424 are using both. But you're right, I think that where there's a choice, the favor right now, at least through the end of the year, is transition BIC because of the lesser requirements.
Yeah, Brad, why don't we just give us a 4 or 5 minute update on tax reform and any insights you have on that being inside the Beltway, and then we'll
sure.
open it up to questions.
Yeah, very briefly, one other bit of important news that happened this week is that they filed the cloture motion in the Senate for debate on Labor Secretary nominee Acosta. And all that is internal procedure to the Senate, which means that a vote will occur probably Wednesday or Thursday to confirm Acosta. And the expectation is that he will be confirmed. He only has to get a majority, and it doesn't look, you know, looks like he'll get at least probably the Republicans voting for him. So he should be confirmed before the end of the week unless something unexpected happens. That's very positive news because the Labor Department obviously doesn't have a Secretary of Labor, doesn't have many of the other Trump-appointed people yet, and as a result, it's been very frustrating for everyone dealing with the Labor Department to not have people from the Trump administration to deal with. So hopefully that's a first step towards getting that agency staffed up, which is going to be vitally important for the future of the fiduciary rule, and talking to them about what changes we might want them to make as a regulatory matter going forward. Just a brief word about that. I think, you know, while we're all focused on June 9th for obvious reasons, shortly after that, we need to turn our attention back to the Labor Department and the Trump administration and essentially pretend it's 3 years ago and explain again what it is we like and don't like and need to see changed about this rule, and sort of start that process over to try and get them to include that information in their review. Comprehensive tax reform, the reason this keeps coming up, and you're probably hearing about it from all your trade associations and everyone else, the reason this keeps coming up is that it is actually, in all likelihood, going to happen. It's going to be a long and complex and unpleasant, you know, negotiation process to get comprehensive tax reform. But one of the biggest problems is if they want to do it on a revenue-neutral basis, they have to raise some revenue from some places even as they cut taxes in others. And so we get into a game of winners and losers. And absolutely, the retirement system is poised to get some wax taken at it and some revenue pulled out. In other words, a diminishment of the tax incentives for retirement savings. And if they do that the wrong way, that could have really disastrous consequences. Even if done the right way, it's not certainly advantageous to the system. One of the concepts that almost everyone on the Hill is speaking favorably about, although how they want to proceed specifically, they don't know yet. And we're going to see the Trump administration's plan probably tomorrow, and that'll give us some light as to what the Trump administration is going to ask for and whether they address retirement tax issues or not. One of the issues that everyone on the Hill seems very interested in is increasing the role of Roth features. In the past, when they've done that, it's been elective. In the future, it'll probably be some version of mandatory. So what do I mean by that? Well, Congress likes to raise, you know, the Roth feature raises revenue this year, which Congress gets to keep, rather than deferring taxation out into the future, which if it's past the 10-year window, Congress views as lost. So for a variety of reasons, Congress prefers Roth as a method for taxing retirement benefits. That is, though, going to have a real effect on the incentives people have for retirement savings. So are they looking at Roth only for the second half of elective contributions, which was the Camp proposal from a few years ago? Are they looking at Roth on the front end? Are they looking at all Roth? Those are all questions that we don't know the answers to yet, but it's a debate they're having. So you all really need to be aware that this comprehensive tax reform debate is going to result in changes to the retirement taxation, and some of those could be very negative. So if you're interested in that issue, which I think we all are, be aware that this debate is happening, and it's not, you know, these aren't abstract concerns. These are real-world issues. Congress is going to be monkeying with the tax treatment of retirement plans, and you need to get involved if you're concerned about how they're going to do that.
Okay, thanks, Brad. Ashley, let's open it up for questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line has been open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, it is star 1. And we'll take our first question. Caller, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Mike Callahan. Thanks, Fred and Brad. Been a great session. I learned a lot from you. Always do. Do we have, on the 408B2 notices, do we have 60 days in which to say the change in fiduciary status from a non-fiduciary broker to a fiduciary broker?
Hi, Mike. My recollection of the wording of that rule, and Brad may have a more top of mind than I do, is that the you have 60 days for a change notice. You have 60 days from the wording is very odd, more or less becoming aware of the change. But my view of that is it would be June 9th. The first recommendation made on or after June 9th would be the beginning date of that 60-day period. So I mean, technically it'd be the first recommendation you make after June 9th, but I would play off of June 9th so you eliminate all argument. Brad, is that your recollection as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could take the view that you'd have 60 days from June 9th. There's also, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, and this is something we really need to nail down specifically. I keep thinking there might also be a 30-day rule there, but I believe 60 days from June 9th could be the outer limit, yeah.
Thank you.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, it is star 1. We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Could you discuss the principal transaction exemption and how that's going to be working in this transitional period?
Brad, will you take that one?
Yeah, so in essence, they did essentially the same treatment for that as they did for the BIC exemption. So it's the impartial conduct standards that would apply to its transition provision. I have to say I have not gone through and looked at that as closely as we have for the other two, but it has essentially the similar relief as the BIC exemption provides. So in other words, the scope of the relief it provides isn't really changed, but the notice requirements, how you go about using it between now and the end of the year, is essentially the same as the BIC exemption.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. The impartial conduct standards.
Mm-hmm. Correct, right. The imposition of the impartial conduct standards is really the primary compliance. But again, it does have its own sort of still existing scope of what it applied to before. They didn't change, unlike 8424, they didn't change the parameters of what type of relief is provided, more the means of how you go about getting the relief for the rest of this year.
Thank you.
Let me go back to Mike Callahan's question. I'm a little odd. I actually have a copy of 408B2 at my desk. Here's what it says, literally. A covered service provider must disclose a change to the information as soon as practicable, but not later than 60 days from the date on which the covered service provider is informed of such change, unless due to extraordinary circumstances, which I can't imagine the extraordinary circumstances here. We pretty much see the train coming at us. So as soon as practicable, which could be less than 60 days, but no later than 60 days, looking at the literal wording, I agree with Brad. I would get that out. I would get it out on June 9th, or if not, then shortly thereafter. I don't know that I would try to take advantage of the full 60 days, because it does say as soon as practicable, which could in theory be shorter than 60 days. I don't actually see it being enforced that way, but there is an outside chance, so why take any risk at all when you see it coming?
Yeah, I would tend to agree, or I'd certainly do it as shortly thereafter as possible. I mean, the other place the Labor Department uses that essentially as soon as practicable, although I think it's as soon as reasonably segregable, but it's a similar concept, is in the notion of delinquent contributions. And I don't think they will enforce it the same way they have been very vigorous on delinquent contributions, I agree with Fred, but I would want to do that sooner rather than later. And if you were to try and tie some other guidance together, it's not directly applicable, but in the FAB on if there had been a gap period, DOL was pointing to some 30-day correction periods under BIC exemptions. I think that's what I was thinking of for the 30 days. Again, not really applicable here, but I wouldn't recommend going beyond 30 days, because at least you'd have something else you could point to as a period of time to do that.
So, operator?
As a reminder, it is star one to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment. And we do have a question. Caller, please go ahead.
This is Ken Mattson of Compensation and Capital. We are a TPA who has been a level fee advisor all the way along and will remain that way for the extent of the engagements that we have. When we're talking to participants on the phone about any kinds of transitions to IRAs, distribution options, changes to their investment structures, et cetera, we have absolutely no conflict of interest in any recommendations that we make. Has our fiduciary relationship before June 9th versus after changed? In other words, in before we were only functional fiduciary, if you will, and thereafter I see that relationship as the same. Do you disagree?
Well, we need to go into a lot of facts, so let me just avoid that and give you a general answer. Any recommendation to a participant, which remember is a suggestion, any recommendation to a participant to take a distribution and roll over to an IRA will be a fiduciary recommendation. So it has to be done prudently, you have to do your research, you have to do a good analysis, and then you have to make a recommendation to the participant with a duty of loyalty. It doesn't matter whether you're a TPA or an RIA or a broker-dealer, anybody that makes that recommendation who will make money off the IRA, because there does have to be some money made, or you're not a fiduciary. It has to be a fee. But so anyone who makes a recommendation and they're going to get some money on it, is a fiduciary. So that's the beginning and end of the fiduciary analysis. Having said that, though, there is an alternative where you can provide education without making a recommendation. That's clear from the preamble to the rules. But let's say a recommendation is made, and let's say the person making the recommendation does a proper analysis and a good recommendation. The second step is to say, is there a prohibited transaction? There can be. For example, if the advisor is making 50 basis points off the plan, but the advisor makes a recommendation and makes 100 basis points a year off the IRA, the advisor just increased his compensation on those dollars from 50 basis points to 100, which is a prohibited transaction. In other words, giving fiduciary advice that causes the advisor to receive additional compensation. That then means you're probably under the best interest contract exemption. And at least for the rest of this year, as Brad pointed out, you just have to adhere to the three impartial conduct standards. Reasonable compensation, no materially misleading statements, and the best interest standard of care. That could get tougher come January 1, depending on what the DOL does in its review of the rules. Brad, do you want to add something to that?
Yeah, just two quick things. One, we didn't really emphasize it on this call, but because they didn't change any of the fiduciary provisions from the Obama regulation, that also means all of the same exclusions apply. Fred mentioned sort of when you're giving a steak dinner to a group that isn't an excluded, it isn't a widely attended event, but going on CNBC and talking about investments is. You have education, as Fred said, and there's several other exclusions from fiduciary advice there that do still apply. So you can educate your way through rollovers without ever making a recommendation, leaving it to the participant to decide what to do. To just reemphasize Fred's point, there are always two questions that you have to answer now on rollovers. One is, did I make a recommendation? And if I did, then I have to go through the right fiduciary process. But this prohibited transaction question, just to reemphasize what Fred said, it's unrelated to the fiduciary advice. Your fiduciary advice has to be prudent and in their best interest. But even if it is, it still results in a prohibited transaction. In other words, the prohibited transaction question, am I affecting my own compensation, is separate from the advice question. And you have to treat them as two distinct issues. For your case, to analyze whether you have a prohibited transaction, you're going to have to look at, the details of how you're getting compensated. Is it affecting your compensation if they follow your recommendation or not? And if it isn't, maybe there isn't a prohibited transaction. There are cases where a rollover will not result in a prohibited transaction. For example, say an advisor who's charging the plan 1% and charging the IRA 1%, hasn't changed the compensation, but that's probably a minority case. In most cases, rollovers are going to equate to prohibited transactions, but the good news, at least through the end of the year, is the transitional BIC exemption basically means just with reliance on the impartial conduct standards, you don't have to face as many difficulties in exempting that prohibited compensation.
Did we do an okay job on that?
Excellent. I'm happy.
Okay. Good.
Well, I got to say, that's not a response I've gotten on almost any question I've answered in the last 2 years, so I'm glad to hear that.
Well, we stacked the deck in this situation because we've been playing that moral high ground for many, many years.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, you're the first one who's been more happy than hysterical with Brad, so that's good news.
Let me hasten to add, that's the fault of the regulation, not the quality of my advice. But that's a whole different issue.
No, absolutely. Advice is good. Hey, operator, we have time for one more question.
Thank you. We'll take our last question. Caller, please go ahead.
This is Pat McCandless in St. Louis, Missouri. I don't know if I can expect a happy response to this, maybe, but regarding being an RIA, we've always served as a 321 or a 338. The 408B2 requirement, that is what you're referring to as, 60 days after June the 9th, that some indication of fiduciary status needs to be shared with whoever is hiring you as a provider, that really sounds like it applies mainly to people who've been serving in a commission capacity. Am I hearing correctly?
Yeah, as a practical matter. Go ahead, Brad.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you. I was just going to say, in your case, if you've already been serving as a fiduciary to plans, you should have been already providing that disclosure since about 2012. So it probably wouldn't result in a change in your disclosure.
Okay.
Yeah, Pat, the way we've done it is, I mean, we talk about this as a separate disclosure document. It doesn't have to be. For RIAs, by and large, we have built it into their advisory agreements with plans, either the 321 or 338 agreement. So it describes your services, it describes your fees, it describes your fiduciary status as an RIA, your fiduciary status as a ERISA fiduciary advisor. So all of that, if it's in your service agreement, as long as, you know, before you're engaged, you deliver your service agreement. Therefore, the plan sponsor or the plan committee has all that information in front of them to make the decision to hire you. You're fine. You don't have to re-up that. You don't become more of a fiduciary because of these new rules if you've already been serving as a fiduciary. So as Brad said, 408B2 should not be an issue for you because you solved it back in 2012 to the extent that you needed to add anything. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry that we need to bring it to an end, but believe me, the fiduciary saga is not coming to the end. So there'll be more of these calls and more to talk about. Let me turn it over to Jim, and we'll talk about, in fact, when the next call will be. We'll be able to update you on this and answer more questions. Jim?
Thanks, Fred, and thank you, Brad, for sharing your insight today. And on behalf of Natixis Global Asset Management, I want to thank everyone for calling in. Please mark your calendars. As Fred said, July 20th will be our next call, and we're looking forward to that. So, again, thanks for the time. And, Ashley, I'll hand it back to you to close out the call.
Thank you. And once again, that does conclude today's presentation. We thank you all for your participation, and you may now disconnect.
Thanks, everyone.